If you've been told to pull up your socks, then make sure it's a pair of TNT socks. The TNT shop is now open at TNTRadio.live. You're with Ross Cameron on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back. It's good to have you with us. The greatest compliment you can pay to a radio host is to tune in. So thanks to my mother and her book club for signing up tonight. I've got John Ruddick on the line with us, John Nettleton Ruddick, Tamworth boy. I confess to you, because we believe in transparency, that I'm a member. John and I are a member of the same political party, so this is going to be a pretty soft interview. But I'm happy to have John on the call because he could easily wind up holding the balance of power in the New South Wales upper house, where rational people are desperate to avoid what could be just a complete blanket of red across continental Australia. If Labor were to win in the New South Wales election next Saturday, they might even have a majority in the upper house with the benefit of the disastrous Greens. John Ruddick, welcome to the show.
Good evening, Ross. Thanks very much for having me.
Well, I'm going to throw you a curveball just to start out, so it's not too soft. I mean, in our news grab in between segments, we heard from Lindsey Graham. Why don't you give our audience a question without notice? What is John Ruddick's opinion of Lindsey Graham?
An extremely dangerous person. This guy is hooked on war. He's never seen a war that he doesn't want to get involved with. Now, I was a believer in the neoconservative agenda. I looked at what the Americans did to Japan. Japan used to be a horrible country, killed tens of millions of people in the 1940s, 1930s and the 1940s. Let off bombs in Sydney Harbour. Okay, and you know, bombed Darwin a hell of a lot more than they bombed Pearl Harbour. There was repeated attacks on Darwin. Okay, now then America goes in, unconditional surrender by the Japanese, and look at Japan today, a fantastic country, a true democracy, a liberal country, a wealthy country, and a peaceful country. And then we look at Germany. You know, we had two horrific wars with Germany in the first half of the last century, and then America goes in, rebuilds West Germany, and Germany today, you know, similar to Japan, a successful country. And I thought, look, after 9/11, we had to hit back, and I thought that, you know, we could do it again. Now what they didn't take into account is that these countries, you know, Afghanistan and Iraq, were, you know, not ready for a liberal democracy for whatever reason. And so we went in there and we wrecked the joint, and we cost a lot of, probably a million Iraqis are dead, and then we had rivers of blood with ISIS and everything flowing directly from that invasion. So by the time Afghanistan and Iraq have gone bad, I'm starting to seriously question, you know, the people that are making these decisions about going to war. But the big turning point for me, Ross, was Libya. Okay, so Gaddafi was the baddie of the 1980s. And but, yeah, President Reagan put him back in his box. But anyway, Gaddafi was a pariah, an international pariah, and was developing a secret nuclear bomb program. Now, after Gaddafi saw what happened to Saddam, Gaddafi rings up the West. He says, hey, look, you know, let's be friends. I've got this nuclear facility. I'm trying to build a nuclear bomb. Come and help me dismantle it. And in exchange, let's have good relations. Tony Blair goes down for a state visit. Everybody's happy. There's a lot of natural wealth in Libya. Libya boomed for the best part of a decade. Libya was going great. There was a lot of wealth. It was getting integrated into the international community. And then we had in 2010 with the Arab Spring, there was like a jihadist uprising in Benghazi. Gaddafi was going in to crush the jihadis. There wasn't a large number of them. And then the West just decided, oh, let's go and smash up Libya, you know, to save Benghazi. Let's go. And they absolutely destroyed Libya. It's still in rubble today. And I'm thinking, okay, well, this was a huge error. And I'm thinking, yeah, these people aren't, they don't care about what happened in Afghanistan and Iraq. They don't care about all the incredible suffering, the human suffering, and the total and the cost of American money and American soldiers were dying, Allied soldiers, you know, putting aside all the suffering by the locals. Then they just go and do it again without any sort of introspection. And then Syria, and now of course we're doing it. I'm doubtful that they're doing the right thing in Ukraine now. You know, every few days I hear it's just escalating. Now Lindsey Graham out there, Lindsey Graham hated Donald Trump, okay, because Donald Trump was about peace, and then he's cozy with Donald Trump these days, but
wants to wrap himself in the legacy of Donald Trump now.
Only because he's got a primary coming up and he wants to win his primary in Trump-loving South Carolina. That's all it is. Look, I wish these people, all these hawks, I really wish they would all go and, you know, barely any of them have actually served in the army themselves, okay? And I think, Ross, that there's people out there that lust for war. There's a reason why the English language has the word warmonger, and these people get a real kick out of it.
Well, I must admit, I was a bit startled to read an article which actually you sent me recently from the great journalist Cy Hirsch, who has recently billed the cat on the bombing of the Nord Stream pipeline. And he was talking, I think it was, I don't know if it was he personally met with JFK or he was reporting someone else's meeting. But yes. JFK was actually expressing the view that he hoped he would have the opportunity to win a war as president, yes. Because only presidents who won wars were really loved and revered as great American presidents. Give us the accurate version of what happened.
Okay. Well, look, Seymour Hirsch was interviewing a person who was a very senior advisor to JFK. And they became friends, Seymour Hirsch became friends, I think, in the 70s. And he has this very, very disturbing account, which you've summed up pretty accurately. JFK, early on in his presidency, he's got sort of six or seven of his top advisors. I think his brother was there. And he says, you know, and this is 1961. This is the height of the Cold War. It's before the Cuban Missile Crisis. And JFK is sitting around thinking, you know, George Washington is revered. Abraham Lincoln is revered. Franklin Roosevelt is revered. And what do they all have in common? They won a big war, big war. And JFK says, I want to win a big war so I can be a great figure like that. And JFK is one of the better presidents, okay? But these people lust for war. And, you know, look, there is a difference. I know that your audience, Ross, is sort of made up of conservatives and libertarians, and there's a lot of overlap between conservatives and libertarians, but I'll tell you there's a big difference when it comes to war. The conservatives glorify war, okay, and the libertarians, because they're distrustful of politicians to start with, they're distrustful of politicians because it's politicians that start wars. Nations don't go to war. The people in each country actually like each other. It's egomaniac politicians that want the glory of winning a big war. But you think about when a lot of German migrants came to this country in the 40s and 50s, they instantly were welcomed by Australians. We Australians and Germans intermarried, and you can't recognise a German someone who had German ancestry today. They're totally Australian. The Japanese, the same thing. Okay, now people like each other. You can meet someone from any country in a non-political environment, and people actually, generally speaking, get along very well with each other. But politicians are mostly motivated by being a saviour, by the glory of it. And this is why the libertarians very much believe, look, it's not left that's bad, it's not right that's bad. We just need a much smaller government. The smaller the government is, the less damage can be done.
Okay, well, John Ruddick, let's talk a little bit about you. You're running for the New South Wales Upper House. You're the number one candidate on the Liberal Democrat ticket. You've got a beating pulse as a candidate, and plenty of people say you're sort of a 50-50 to get over the line. You were born in Tamworth. Tell us about your father was I think originally reporter, then editor of the local newspaper. Tell us about growing up in Tamworth.
Okay, well, I do think of myself as a Tamworth boy. I was actually born in South Australia, in Mount Gambier. We moved to Tamworth when we were three. My mother was from Auckland, New Zealand. And
A piano. Was she a music teacher, your mother?
Yes. She had a little piano studio at our home. And look, we always grew up watching the news and reading the newspapers and talking about politics. And I remember the first political event that really captured me was the Iran hostage crisis. And I was only 9 years old. And that went on for about a year and a half, and I was gripped by it. Now, we had limited news in Tamworth in 1979. We had the ABC News on TV, we had the Channel 7 News, and we had the Sydney Morning Herald plus the local paper. And I would basically get up in the morning and read about what's happening in Iran, and I felt immense sympathy for these Americans that were held hostage there. And I was sort of, you know, gripped by it. And I remember our family was actually driving to Sydney, which was quite a long drive in those days. The roads were nowhere near as good as they are now. And it was the day that Ronald Reagan had been inaugurated, and the Ayatollah immediately released the hostages. And I just sort of started off with a very positive view of Ronald Reagan. Now, Ronald Reagan and Donald Trump were both told, we were both told by their political enemies that they were warmongers that were risking World War III. And the truth is the complete opposite. Ronald Reagan struck up a friendship with Mikhail Gorbachev, and their friendship defused the Cold War. And it was really Reagan that reached out. And, you know, when they had their first summit in Geneva in 1985, Reagan's just re-elected. Gorbachev is recently become the general secretary because they had a couple of people had a very short period as sort of the president of Russia. And Reagan, when they sat down at Geneva to have a discussion, they've got like about 20 of their advisors on each side of the table. And they'd had Kennedy and Khrushchev had had a meeting in Vienna, actually, nearby. And it ended very stormily, very, very badly. Khrushchev and Kennedy, they didn't get along at all. But Reagan sits down with Gorbachev. They haven't met before. And the first thing Reagan says to Gorbachev across the table with all their advisors and generals and CIA and KGB and everything else, Reagan says to Gorbachev via his interpreter, he says, look, why don't just you, me, one of my interpreters, let's walk down to the lake and have a little get-to-know-you chat. And Gorbachev immediately says, yes, let's do that. So they leave all their advisors to talk. Gorbachev, Reagan, and one translator each, walk down to the lake and they light a little fire. They have a little campfire and they sat there for about 6 hours and they got along terrifically, okay? And the world was excited about it. I mean, growing up in the 1980s, the threat of a nuclear war was very, very real. And the Soviet Union and the United States were arming up. And it was the goodness of Ronald Reagan that defused it. Now, the same thing happened with Trump. All these people that hate Trump still hate Trump. I think they're going to arrest him in about 48 hours. We might get to that later. But they, Trump says about this North, just one example, you know, about the North Korean thing. We've spent the last 30 years fearful that one day we're going to wake up and the magnificent city of Seoul, South Korea, is going to be nuked by the lunatics in North Korea. Trump writes to him. Crazy boy in Rocket Man in Pyongyang. He says, look, why don't we catch up? Kim Jong-un. Trump says, look, why don't we catch up? And they caught up in Singapore and they had a terrific time and Trump defused that situation. It was unorthodox diplomacy, but boy, oh boy, it worked in terms of defusing it. Now, the North Korean people are still suffering, okay, and it's a terrible situation. Trump had outlined to Kim Jong-un, said, look, we want to help you. We want to have a lot of trade. We want to relax the sanctions, you know, but you've got to start to liberalize. Now, he didn't do that. But look, it was a big step forward, okay? And then also Trump didn't.
Then we get to the Abraham Accords.
Well, the Abraham Accords, which only have been strengthened, okay, as time has gone on, which is absolutely terrific. And then, you know, when Trump, when Citizen Trump's running for the Republican nomination, he's giving an interview, I think, to MSNBC or something, and they said, well, what's your view on Putin? And Trump just very casually sort of, and probably naively, says, oh, well, look, I'd like to have a good relationship with him. I'd like to try and, you know, see if we can cooperate. Oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy, you know, that's the worst thing in the world, okay, that Donald Trump, people like Lindsey Graham were saying, you know, the warmongers were saying it's the worst thing in the world that Trump wants to be friends with Russia. And I'm thinking, gee, you know, we've got this little planet here with 8 billion of us and all the animals and everything else. We don't know if there's any other life in the universe. This could be it, okay? We've got on this planet, we've got these two massive nuclear arsenals. And Trump says, well, I want to be friends with Russia. Oh, you know, oh, they hate that. They hate that. And, you know, I'll tell you that another interesting thing that came out last week, Ross, was, you know, this ASPE thing. This ASPE, yes.
Australian Strategic Policy Institute hasn't had a strategic idea in 20 years. Keep going.
Oh, and it's just, they just want war. But it came out last week on Channel 9, Chris O'Keefe on Channel 9. I didn't know this. ASPE's funded by all the defence contractors, all the bastards that make billions off war. And I'm thinking, okay, well, that's interesting. I wish I knew that before. I've been reading Peter Jennings in the paper telling us how we need war with everybody, war everywhere. Oh, who's paying his pay packet? The defence contractors.
Okay, Johnny, hit pause. I know we're on a bit of a roll. I keep forgetting we've got a New South Wales election coming up and you've got a job to do.
Yes.
So tell us, look, because I suppose we can take another five or so minutes. Tell us about this energy situation in New South Wales and why a rational person should be willing to vote for John Ruddick at number one in the upper house in order to protect energy supply and to keep down the cost of electricity.
Okay, so the purest libertarian view on policy is what I believe in, which is we believe the government should get out of the energy market and therefore all forms of energy can flourish. So we can have coal, gas, nuclear, and, of course, if the unreliables, also known as renewables, can deliver in the free market, well, good on them for doing that. The government should get out of it. Now, that's the ideal. Now, we have this crisis. We have this looming crisis coming our way. We've got winter around the corner where we've gone so hell-bent on the unreliables and it's failing in other countries. It's not working, okay, and it's barely working. And so we've got the duopoly, Liberal and Labor, a complete agreement, you know, let's shut down the coal industry, let's switch over to unreliables and it'll work perfectly. Well, it's not working, but it's like this religious dogma they've got in their head. They can't think either way. And these politicians, they basically just want to respond to what the voters think. Okay, well, in the key seats, you know, the so-called teal seats, so they just do what the focus groups say. Oh, yeah, people care about it. I think that there's also, I think that the politicians want to be seen to be the heroes of this renewable revolution. But underpinning it, of course, is crony capitalists who are gouging on all this money floating around. Okay, all these government subsidies. So, yes, we are going to be absolutely pro the coal industry. But, you know, we have to be honest, Ross. This is, I know Mark Latham's very good on this subject, but we go further than One Nation. Certainly the New South Wales Liberal Democrats do, and that is we are sceptical of the global warming orthodoxy, period. We believe it's junk science. We believe with Professor Ian Plimer. And so there's no point going out there and saying, oh, we support the coal industry, if you don't have the guts to also say, yeah, well, look, it's junk science. Because you know what? If it's true, if the world is coming to an end because of global warming, well, of course we have to take every measure we can to prevent it. That's the key thing. We've got to say it's not. It's just another doomsday cult. There's been about 2 million in history in the past. This is the latest doomsday cult.
Well, it's an extraordinary situation where we've got a national government. We're going to have Lucy Hood and Ben Hood, both members of the South Australian Parliament, on right after your segment. But we've got an extraordinary situation where Anthony Albanese is saying he's entirely comfortable for Rolls-Royce to build a nuclear reactor in Britain, put it on a ship, send it to South Australia, shove it in the back of a nuclear submarine, and for Australia to build the waste disposal facility for the nuclear attack submarine, but Australians cannot have nuclear energy to keep the lights on and keep pensioners warm in their homes.
You know, we've got 1/3 of the proven reserves of uranium in the world, Ross, and we haven't even been looking for uranium. Okay. Now, Canada's looked for uranium. They've got about half the proven reserves of us. Russia's got a lot. They're looking for it too. We don't look for it because we're not allowed to mine it. Okay. But we've still got as the whole of Australia, our whole economy could be underpinned by really cheap nuclear-based energy. And, you know, the morons in the Liberal and the Labor Party don't want to do it.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, there you have it, straight from the horse's mouth, John Ruddick, number one upper house candidate. How does somebody vote for John Ruddick if they're walking into the ballot box at the pre-poll this week or on election day next Saturday?
Well, look, there's some parties out there that aren't recommending preferences. We proudly are recommending preferences. One, vote above the line, one Liberal Democrat, two IMOP, three One Nation, four the Shooters, five the Coalition. Now, some of the Liberal National Coalition, and we're putting them at five. Now, some of your listeners may think, well, why are you rewarding them? Well, look, at the end of the day, we don't want our votes to exhaust. And Liberals are bad, Labor's worse. Okay, so that was the rational decision that the party made, and I support it.
Well, thanks very much. We love reason and rationality on the Ross Cameron Show. We love John Ruddick. We wish you the best, mate. We hope that in a week's time you'll be endorsed as a member of the New South Wales Upper House. Good luck. Godspeed. Ladies and gentlemen, stay with us because we have Lucy Hood, the Labor member for Adelaide, and Ben Hood, the Liberal member for the South Australian Legislative Council. We'll be right back.
TNT Radio's Lynn Shaw.
Women and girls, this whole society, we've been normalizing this sexualization of our children over the past few decades. And it has really come to a head right now in 2023. And where is all of this going? Let's review. Girls, we see are promoted as being very sexy. Let's go on OnlyFans, quit your job as a teacher because you can make hundreds of thousands on OnlyFans if you take off your clothes. We know, big tech, there is no accountability. Our government, this is my opinion, are complicit in allowing all of this, where the algorithms are directing all of us online. But we want to stick to talking about the kids right now. Eating disorders, things about plastic surgery, cyberbullying. The kids are looking at what everybody else has. That old saying, you know, that the grass is always greener on the other side. And our girls are being marginalized. We also, I find this incredible in 2023, where I am sitting in the middle of New York City and we are promoting the full decriminalization of the sex trade. So how can we be pro-women and support this?
Lynn Shaw on TNT Radio.
The largest ingredient we have here is love.
Food is love. Love is food.
What God's love has always done is given people a platform to be able to show up and do something of service and think, yes, I've contributed to fighting back this pandemic.
And we're continuing to cook for and feed people who are underserved.
They rely on us before the pandemic. So I know with everything that's going on, they rely on us even more.
During the height of the crisis, each and every one of our drivers showed up every day.
As long as this place is open, and this place will be open as long as it's humanly possible, we will make sure you're served your food.
When COVID first hit, the main thing that really clicked in my head was our clients. Just clients, 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 clients. That's it.
You build a relationship with clients when you see them so often. They start to feel like you're a family member.
I try to have them smile before I leave their door.
And deliver the food with love.
We're here to deliver, and that's the job, and that's what we're going to continue to do.
If we don't do it, who would?
It's my job to make sure they're well fed and all their meals are prepared in the right, correct way.
I had a best friend who actually passed away from HIV in 2018. I'm still giving her the chance to live life inside of me, providing meals for the clients.
My father got a stroke a couple of years ago, and I think about him. And when I cook over here, it's like cook for my family.
My grandmother died of Alzheimer's, and I know if she had this company, she would live a little longer. That's why I'm here.
And I think that it's kind of difficult to not make it personal.
I was needed, so I had to be there.
To know that I'm here, help feed them, I feel like a superhero.
My name is Ronnie Overson, and I'm a frontline worker for God's Love We Deliver.
And I'm a frontline worker here at God's Love We Deliver.
Y soy un trabajador de primera línea para God's Love We Deliver.
And I'm a frontline worker here at God's Love We Deliver.
Visit glwd.org to learn how you can get involved. A message brought to you by TNT Radio.
What kind of talk is this?
What the heck are you even talking about?
Freedom of speech. Freedom of movement. Freedom of choice. Freedom of assembly. Freedom of health. Our freedom. The voice of freedom is TNT Radio.
Well, ABC reported recently a speech in the South Australian Parliament from which I will quote, "The fact that two kids born in the same country hospital to the same parents, the exact same upbringing, the same public education, can find themselves here together through just sheer determination and hard work, representing the communities that we love. I think it's a sign that there is probably more that unites us than divides us." Well, that speech was delivered by Lucy Hood, welcoming her brother Ben Hood to the upper house of the South Australian Parliament. Lucy representing the Labor Party in the lower house, Ben the Liberal Party in the upper house. It's great to have you both on the Ross Cameron Show.
Thanks so much for having us, Ross.
Thank you, Ross.
So, Ben, you are the elder sibling, is that right?
That's right, Ross. Yes, I'm Lucy's big brother.
And she does say really quite sweet things about you as an older brother. It sounds like you weren't too much of a bossy authoritarian.
No, Ross. Well, with Lucy and I growing up, along with our brother Toby and brother Liam, we were raised by our mum. When our mum and dad ultimately split up, we moved into town from off the farm in Bullagoon. And from the age of 11, I suppose became a bit of the father figure for Lucy and Toby before Liam came along. I'd cook dinner for Lucy and Toby and put them to bed while mum was working nights in aged care. So we've always been close. We've always had a great respect for each other and a great love for each other. And, you know, and that continues on, even though we do now find ourselves on opposite sides of the political spectrum here in the state.
Well, I'm going to get to that in a moment, to how, as Lucy points out, you know, coming from, in effect, the same sort of DNA, the same community, the same education, you've wound up on, some would say, different sides of the political argument. But before I do, I mean, Lucy paid a lovely compliment to you in relation to her desperate desire to acquire a pair of pink sunglasses. Lucy, do you want to tell us what that was all about?
Yeah, so I had my eye on these hot pink Oakley sunglasses. We were always taught in our family, and particularly growing up on a farm, you pretty much start working as soon as you can walk. But the minute you were legally able to get a paid job, we did. So I know Ben worked at the deli at the local Woolies, and just alongside the local Woolies was a cafe called Blacksmith's Cafe. So I remember on my 14th birthday, walking in there, asking for a job and started working as a waitress. But, gosh, you probably got paid around maybe $6 an hour. back then. So I had my eye on these pair of Oakley sunglasses and I put them on lay-by. So lay-by was a thing back then. I guess we all have Afterpay now. But yeah, popped them on lay-by and was madly trying to, you know, gradually pay them off within the time period that was given to me. But I guess Ben was the type of brother. He'd left school at that point, was working in graphic design, and he was just the type of big brother and knew how much I wanted them, and so one day surprised me by paying them off.
Well, never get in the way of the desire of a 14-year-old girl for a pair of pink sunglasses.
Exactly.
Ben, since you probably know Lucy better than, you know, just about anyone, maybe not a husband and two kids, but if you were going to describe Lucy to, if you were to give, write the briefing note to someone who was about to meet Lucy, maybe a constituent trying to get an outcome who wanted to appeal to Lucy's better instincts, I mean, how would you describe your sister?
Well, it's a great question, Ross, and you know, without getting too emotional about it, if I was to describe Luce, that's how I affectionately call my sister. I don't think I know anyone who is more empathetic and genuine. Lucy can speak with anyone from a shearer right up to, you know, a high-flying government official and be able to speak with them on their level. Lucy just has such a huge heart, not only for her community, for her state, but also for her family and friends. And that really just sums up Lucy, someone who will understand and be on the level of the person she's talking to honestly and genuinely and meaningfully. There's no pretense about it. There is no, you know, there's nothing false about Lucy when she speaks with you and when she listens and tries to understand where you're coming from, and that's her greatest strength, quite honestly.
Well, look, I'd find it hard not to vote for her on the basis of that recommendation.
But, I think it's just because I cooked Ben a really nice dinner tonight. So.
Yeah, but it was vegetarian, so I don't know. Sorry. Yeah, we lost some points on the vegetarian point, but anyway.
So, Luce, is Luce a vegetarian?
No, I've just tried to be conscious of when you grow up on a farm, you pretty much live on chops, all right, lamb chops. And so I've grown up my entire life thinking that you don't have a proper meal unless you've got a few animals on the plate. So I'm just trying to be a little bit conscious of perhaps how much meat that I do tend to eat. I'm definitely a carnivore, and so I'm just trying to be a little bit more conscious of that, and it really just forces me to eat a few more veggies. So unfortunately Ben had to have a roast tonight, but what I didn't tell him was that there was no roast, it was just roast vegetables.
Well, speaking of carnivores, I did treat myself this afternoon to quite a beautiful, I thought, musical composition. I think it was called We Love Beef, and it was by Farmer George.
That's
and
right.
Farmer George, why don't I ask Lucy to give the introduction to Farmer George?
Yes, yeah, so Ben is an incredibly talented artist, a graphic artist, and he and his business partner Simone co-created a character called George the Farmer, which is all about teaching kids about where food and fibre comes from. And he's a bit of a larrikin. He obviously loves beef. And as well as a talented graphic designer, Ben's also a talented musician. So not only does Ben draw all of the George the Farmer books and educational materials, but he also is the voice behind George the Farmer's musical career. And so you will find some great classics on George the Farmer's CD, like We Love Beef. The Mango Bango is one of my favourites, and also the Harvest Hop. So unfortunately, I always joke that my brothers, Ben kind of stole all the good genes and left my brothers and I to fight it out for the rest. And so Ben definitely stole the creative and singing genes. So I'll give all your listeners a break by not hearing me sing Mango Bango or We Love Beef. Or The Food in the Fridge is from the Farm is also another favourite of mine. But again, well, I won't sing it for your listeners.
I'm going to say George the Farmer is a ranger. Was there a reason you made him? I'm quite having produced a couple of them myself. Ben, tell us about the personality of George the Farmer.
Yeah, thanks, Ross. Yeah, well, look, George was born out of the point in time where my business partner Simone had her twin boys on the way. She had her son George, and she couldn't find anything that was relating to Australian agriculture for her son George to be able to play on the iPad. So Simone gave me a call and said, look, Ben, I think we've got to create a farming character talking about sequential stories about ag. I said, that's a fantastic idea. I started drawing George and what George would look like. And funnily enough, George is a bit of an amalgam of Simone's husband, Justin, and also quite a bit of a larrikin personality around Panola in South Australia's southeast, called George Kidman. George Kidman is a bit of a cricket loving, sport loving fellow. I actually went to school with him in Narracourt. So we sort of smushed a whole heap of people we knew together that operated in the ag circles and primary industries, and that's how George was born. But George is essentially teaching kids about where their food and fiber comes from, and it's vitally important that we do that, because when we were going into George and starting to set up George, we found some pretty amazing stats that one in three year six kids can't identify a loaf of bread or a banana or a bottle of milk as something that comes from a farm. Now, if we've got kids who don't actually know where their food is coming from, how are they going to be making sensible choices about their nutrition in the future? We know that a great diet, of meat and of veggies, helps developing brains for our kids. So Simone and I got to work and we started putting together George the Farmer. It started off as an interactive story app. We then branched out into music and performance. We've got a TV show, and for every 50 cents that we make off the sale of all of our books, of which we've got 14 picture books now, we reinvest that 50 cents into producing curriculum-aligned teachers' guides. And they've been downloaded over 10,000 times now. So that equates to about 40,000 kids around Australia learning about where their food and fibre comes from with George the Farmer. So, it's been a real buzz for me to be able to be involved in that and be a creator of that along with Simone.
Well, I have to tell you, I think you've got a musical talent. I enjoyed We Love Beef, and I would thoroughly recommend the listeners to the Ross Cameron Show to get onto YouTube, look up George the Farmer, We Love Beef. You'll enjoy it. Especially good to play if any of your vegan or vegetarian relatives are coming over for dinner. But let's get down to this this interesting question about how it was out of the same, in effect, sort of ecological test tube that we get one committed Labor sibling. And Lucy, I understand, was even the current Premier's sort of head of policy development for Labor.
That's correct.
And now we have been getting elected, and my sort of Liberal mates in South Australia, the reason why I sort of reached out in the first place was when I spoke to a mate of mine in South Australia, a former senator, and said, well, who's coming through the ranks who you rate as a weight-bearing strut in the Liberal Party? And he said, "Oh, we've just elected this terrific bloke, Ben Hood, to the upper house." So, what I'd like to understand is how you wound up on different sides of the argument. And I'd like to do it following the format so far of asking you to describe your siblings' political philosophy rather than your own. And I thought we might ask the older brother to go first.
Thanks, Ross. Gee, you've You're putting me on the spot here. It is the hot seat because I'm literally standing across from Lucy, and I'm in arm's length. So there might be a
you're not getting dessert.
That's right.
Getting it wrong.
look, Lucy obviously took a different path to me ultimately because she did tremendously well in Narrancourt High School, got a very, very high score in year 12 and opted to go to the city. And Lucy then obviously fell in with the very wrong crowd. but I think that's what it comes down to is Lucy went to the city and did her journalism degree and went to work for the Advertiser and then slowly worked her way up as a media advisor in the Labor Party. And ultimately Lucy's, I think, political ideology is inherently tied to the fact that we were raised by a single mum and it was about public school. And if we didn't have the healthcare card, that ultimately things would have been pretty rough for us. Now, that's not to say that the Liberal Party isn't a party that that does help people who are in need and has provision for that. Of course, it's very important that we do that. But, I think that, Lucy's political leanings do rest in that and how Labor have probably in the past, positioned themselves to be, the bastions of those types of things. So that's ultimately where Lucy has fallen. And again, I do make the joke that that she has fallen in with the wrong crowd a little bit. And I do tease her and call her a card carrying communist at times. But ultimately, we are looking to achieve what we can for our state, the best that we can achieve for our state, and we're ultimately just taking different paths to get there.
Yeah.
Well, look, go ahead, Lucy. You have a crack now.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it is something that we've probably reflected on in the past couple of months as Ben was campaigning for this vacancy in the upper house. I guess I describe it as we lived in two very different worlds of growing up on a farm with a conservative liberal farming family. The Hoods family are conservative liberals and always have been and no doubt always will be. But the fact is our parents did divorce when we were very young, and so we did live these two very different lives of living on the farm on the weekends, working on the farm, cleaning the troughs. Like I told the story about how Ben was such a great big brother. He let me drive the ute to clean the troughs and I was seven. But then during the week, I lived a life of we had mum who was a single mum. She worked nights at the aged care home. Ben would look after us. And I faced the realities of perhaps when Ben left school and got a trade, went to trade school and followed down that path, I continued on with schooling. And it was little things like the impact of after our mum remarried and had our little brother and we lost our stepdad when he was just 44 to cancer. And so around those, they were such formative years for me because we lived the experience of the health of the public healthcare system. I never forget the oncologist saying to us the difference between us as public patients and his private patients as he sees us on Mondays and them on Tuesdays. It was experiences like having to leave our country town and move up to the city and being accepted into that community, having support from a social worker to find us housing so that our stepdad could have cancer treatment. And then after we lost him, going out to the letterbox and watching mum just desperately wait for the school card to arrive in the letterbox, which meant that she could afford to pay for our school books for that year. So living those two very different lives, it's obviously been, I think, really beneficial in many ways for us because like myself, like Ben, we are willing to have a chat and find a commonality with every single person that we meet. And because we've lived all those different lives of primary producers, of kids of a single mum, of going through the healthcare system. I guess where Ben and I probably diverged is that, he left school, got a trade. Like I can't imagine how challenging that would have been as a kid. What were you, 16?
Yeah,
leaving 16. School, you know, that's the time where all your mates are having a great time in high school. You know, you're playing sport, you're catching up with friends on the weekend. But Ben, he left and was working so hard from the age of 16 to get a trade and to work hard in a business, eventually leading to establishing his own small businesses, whereas I continued on with school and became the first in the family to go to uni. So it is where we probably diverged and that's where our paths, they started to look a little bit different.
Well, look, we've got to go. We've got to leave you now. So we won't have time to get into Ben's Star Wars Lego collection.
Come on, Ross, give me another 10 minutes, mate.
Or indeed Lucy's Pokemon collection.
Oh, yes, I love it.
But, look, it is lovely to find the fact that you're coming to us from around the same dining table that Lucy has produced a great vegetable roast. We wish you well in your endeavours to do something good for South Australia. We want to congratulate the family, you know, your mother, in producing two members of Parliament as a single mother. Not a bad effort. So from the Ross Cameron Show and its modest audience, so thanks for coming on the show. We've loved having you. We hope we might do it again.
Thank you, Ross.
Thank you so much for having us, Ross, and thanks to all your listeners.
Yep.
It's a pleasure. We'll be back. You can actually see Lucy from time to time on the Andrew Bolt Show, so she's coming towards the light. We're going to take a break and finish up with a Ross Cameron rant in just a few moments.
With his expert analysis and opinion,
this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen testified before the Senate Finance Committee today, and she admitted that the Fed's rate hikes played a role in the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank. She also admitted that Silicon Valley Bank received special treatment and that community banks might not be so lucky. Indeed, she all but said the quiet parts out loud. Hey, Heartland, and all you red state MAGA mutts, we hate you. In case you hadn't figured it out, we will contaminate your air and water. We will shutter your banks and businesses. We will kill off all your livestock. We will poison your fields. And we will smoke you out one way or another. We want you dead. Oh, and she also admitted that Social Security benefits will be 24% lower in 9 years when the federal government's retirement Ponzi scheme finally goes bankrupt. Not to worry, I've known since the 1980s that I and my generation were going to get stiffed on Social Security. From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
Some people won't give you the real talk on drugs, but it's time we know the facts. Fentanyl is often laced into illicit drugs and used to make fake versions of prescription pills. You can't see it, taste it, or smell it. Suppliers mix fentanyl into their products because it's potent and cheap, and the dealer might not even know. Keep yourself and others safe by knowing the real deal on fentanyl. Get the facts. Go to realdealonfentanyl.com. This message is brought to you by the Ad Council.
If you're talking about it,
playing games with the debt ceiling is dangerous and would spell disaster.
We're talking about
today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Well, we did have a piece of actual news this week, unlike what passes for news coming out of organizations described as news bureaus. When a very senior figure of Australia's currently dominant political party launched a ballistic missile into the guts of his own party. The senior figure was indeed a former prime minister, indeed the most revered of living prime ministers in the Australian Labor Party. Didn't leave the Liberals out, but it's an unusual moment when anyone attacks their own party. And so we had Keating just unleashed, ripped the scab off AUKUS and the submarine deal. And I mean, we can go through some of the language, which is certainly Keating-esque. I don't think there's any doubt that he is peerless in his mastery of the vernacular, in particular when it's in the form of an insult. But fair to say, look, you're stepping back, Paul Keating has bet his entire legacy on this intervention. Keating says of his own Prime Minister Albanese that he is befuddled and has, quote, no perceptive ability to understand the weight of the decisions he's being asked to make. He describes him as what other people call incompetence. He says that this government, the Albanese government, does not employ foreign policy. He says that the AUKUS deal is the worst deal in history. He says Foreign Minister Penny Wong is seriously unwise and compromised. He says that as a consequence of a tactical decision to avoid creating any opening for the Liberal Party to attack Labor going into the during her 5 years as opposition foreign affairs spokesman, she rustled not a leaf. Keating says that Penny Wong is compromised. Keating says Defence Minister Richard Marles is seriously unwise, well-intentioned, but completely captured. Keating described Maurice Payne as the greatest non-minister of our time. But he didn't limit his attack to Australian political figures, described President Joe Biden as being hardly able to put together three coherent sentences. He spoke of Boris Johnson as one of the great vulgarians of our time. He said Australia's domestic spy agencies are dopey. He quoted the best friend we had in Asia, the Indonesian president, three ago, Yudo Ono. He said the best friend we had in Asia barracking for us was Yudo Ono. These dopes in ASIS tapped his telephone and that of his wife. This is what happens if you let these security agencies, ning-nongs, take control. Keating described Peter Hatcher as a psychopath, a provocateur, old acid drop, stentorian voice but lacking a stentorian mind. And that just gives you a bit of a flavour of the unleashing. Interestingly, if any of the listeners to the Ross Cameron Show want to go and actually get the transcript of Keating's remarks at the National Press Club, you will find it exceptionally difficult to find. And I have sort of searched for it. I have found it referred to, but the National Press Gallery is apparently very reluctant to provide the transcript. I thought that was their job. But Keating made a series of more substantive rational arguments in his critique relating to both the elements of the deal, under which he pointed out at potentially $380 billion. Paul Kelly in The Australian admitted, frankly, we've got no idea what it will cost. Keating said there were three blokes smiling in San Diego in a kabuki theatre. He said, but only one bloke was paying, our bloke, Albo. He talked about the problem of an 8,000-ton object moving slowly through the water as being immediately detectable by satellite by the time these boats arrive. And more importantly, he argued that it wasn't just the cash cost of the deal that Australians have to bear, but it is the cash cost of the deal we have destroyed with China, which will indeed eclipse that of the submarines. And I just say, I'm not making any judgment this week about the Keating thesis. I might do that next week. But it is very rare to have such a senior figure, so deeply enmeshed in the DNA of modern Labor, who has come out and expressed no confidence in the Australian government. He's naturally being vilified in all of the segments of the media who are cheering on this $380 billion sort of three-decade-long deal. But I think we have to admit, if we admire courage, you know, Keating may be wrong, but we have to say he is very clear in his analysis, and he has bet the bank, bet his entire legacy and place in the Australian Labor Party on this critique. So as a person from a different political party, I have to pause and listen and study and understand the thesis. And his argument is that Labor doesn't have a foreign affairs policy, it only has a defence policy. And that that defence policy, in his mind, is seriously unwise. And so I think all Australians owe Keating the courtesy of at least understanding the argument that he's trying to make, that he has made. And I think next week we might gather together some of the for and against opinions, and we'll let the Ross Cameron Show audience decide for themselves. Perhaps the National Press Club might help by providing us with the transcript. So until then, we wish all the candidates going into the New South Wales election this week. The decision will have been made by the time we meet again. But I certainly hope you'll support John Ruddock and the Liberal Democrats in the New South Wales Upper House. But thanks for your company tonight. We hope you'll join us again next Sunday night, 8 to 10 p.m. Sydney time, which I regard as proper time. Thanks for being with us.